Anyway, so my talk is called The Weak Gravity Conjecture for Everyone. And the weak gravity conjecture, I'm going to abbreviate as WGC from now on. And this is work I've been doing with Raman Sundaram and Prashant Saraswat in Maryland a few months ago. And I guess I didn't list my name. I'm Anton De La Fuente. Okay, so I'm first going to give a quick introduction to the WGC, and then after that I will give an outline of my talk. Okay, so we know at high energies, we believe that the quantum effects of gravity are going to be important, and therefore there's going to be a quantum theory of gravity that should replace our current effective theory at high energies. But whatever that theory is, we know that at lower energies it should reduce to effective theory. So at high energies, perhaps it might not even be a quantum field theory anymore, but at lower energies it should reduce to effective theory. So this is going to be some requirement, okay? And one example of a quantum theory of gravity is string theory. And famously, string theory actually reduces to a lot of effective theories. For example, it can reduce to EFT1, EFT2, dot, 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 maybe 10 to the 500 of them. But even though there's a lot, even though this seems like a large amount of effective field theories, conceivably you can think of a continuous infinity of effective theories, right? You would think it's a measure zero subset of the total possible amount of consistent effective theories. And so there is a concept, there's the idea that perhaps there are some effective theories that are not accessible as a low energy limit of string theory. So they live outside this landscape. This is called the string theory landscape. And such theories are said to live in the swampland. The swampland, again, is the set of otherwise consistent effective field theories that do not arise as a low energy limit from string theory. Okay, that's the concept of the swampland. Of course, from a low energy perspective, it would be very nice to know if there are any properties so let's say you just meet a random EFT on the street. It'd be nice if you could find out if there's some property of that EFT that tells you that is whether he lives in the swampland or he lives in the landscape. And there's been a property that's been conjectured called the weak gravity conjecture.
So before you go, this effective set of field theories can be very well tuned and unnatural, right?
Yeah, very well tuned and unnatural. Yes, it can be very well tuned and unnatural. But the central concept is there might be some theories that do not lie in this set. You're saying these sets could also be tuned in a natural.
Yeah, that's true.
But at the moment, I'm focusing on the distinction of being in the set and not being in the set, not whether or not this set is tuned or not. Okay. And so one conjecture is that for any theory that actually resides in the landscape, that is a low energy limit of string theory, it's always going to be true that there will be some particle in that theory, this is the conjecture, for which gravity is the weakest force. By that, I mean this dumb statement, that the force of gravity is less than the force of E and M, right? This is a statement about a particle charged under the U1 symmetry, okay? And if I write the Newton constant as 1 over M Planck squared, just by algebra, it becomes this. That means, I can read this as the gravitational charge of a particle is going to be less than its electric charge. And units, I'll often use units where M Planck is 1. So the weak gravity conjecture just states that there's always going to be some particle whose mass is less than its charge in Planck units. Meaning, if you have an effective theory, so the conjecture is if you have an effective theory such that no particle satisfies this, then that theory is in the swampland. That's the conjecture. Okay. So here's my outline. There's basically three main messages I'd like to get across from this talk. The first is, if you think about the WGC, can actually, if you translate it into the CFT, a conformal field theory language via the ADSC CFT correspondence, you can phrase it in terms of a version of Noether's theorem in the CFT, a CFT version of Noether's theorem. Okay. The second statement I would like to make, message I would like to get across, is just now assuming that you want to satisfy the WGC as a model builder, what does it require model builders to do? And that, so basically, the WGC will require model builders to include particles and cutoffs that ensure all black holes are can decay. Again, I'm going to go through these, but these are the main messages. And the last message I want to say is that despite recent claims in the literature, there are two axion models can achieve trans-Planckian field transits while remaining consistent with the WGC. There's been recent claims in the literature just in the last few months saying that a certain class of models cannot achieve trans-Planckian field transits and remain consistent with the WGC. We are going to show a class of models, a model in that class that actually does achieve trans-Planckian field transits, and so I will have to talk about the loophole or something that in these recent claims. Okay. So let me talk first about the WGC as the CFT version of Noether's theorem.
Electron, I do that with some effective field theory that only has neutrinos, I guess,
and
photons. How would that satisfy?
Let's see. Yeah, so I guess that the game we play is that if you can embed, if the theory can be achieved from a theory that satisfies the weak gravity conjecture, then we say it satisfies the weak gravity conjecture. So if the standard model satisfies the weak gravity conjecture, then
so then I would be able to tell, this conjecture would tell me nothing about this.
Yes.
Why is this a criteria then?
So you're saying a photon, there's no, yeah, that's a good question.
The neutrinos don't have, we can interact. The neutrinos can be emitted from a black hole with no problem, right? Because they don't have any conserved charge. So, I mean, if you take the requirement that the black hole should decay in neutrinos, the black hole can emit infinite number of neutrinos with no problem.
Right.
But if you have a concept, he's just about to explain this.
Yeah, so I'm gonna talk about the reason for the conjecture, and then since I'm not thinking fast enough on my feet how to apply this neutrino, let's see if the neutrino, if that lower energy theory you're suggesting makes it so that black holes can't decay. Okay, so let's apply this criterion to the lower energy, to the effective theory you just proposed. Okay, so basically. The statement is, the question is why should such a conjecture be true? And the claim given in the original paper is that if such a conjecture is not true, you will have an infinite number of exactly stable states. So I'm going to go through that argument. So the question is, and the claim would be that such a theory of quantum gravity should not have an infinite number of exactly stable states. We'll investigate that claim separately, but first, the statement is a sharp statement that if the WGC is violated, you will have an infinite number of exactly stable states.
Why was it a problem?
Yeah, good question. I will answer. I will look into that later. Okay. So here I'm assuming I have a black hole, an extremely charged black hole. A black hole meaning it has its charge is equal to its mass in Planck units, and then just let's say it decays into a bunch of particles. Qi and mi. Okay, so they have part. Each particle has charge qi and mass mi. And so, just the condition for it to decay will be, you know, charge conservation means, you know, the sum of the charges should equal the initial charge, and you know, energy conservation. This could be an equal sign. It doesn't really matter. The sum of the masses should equal the initial mass, right? By energy conservation. And I'm now assuming, since I'm assuming it's a black hole, it's an extreme black hole, I'm saying this equals that. So therefore, the sum of the QIs are going to be bigger than the sum of the MIs. And it's a very simple statement to show that if the sum of the QIs are bigger than the sum of our MIs, there at least is one particle whose charge is bigger than its mass. Okay. If no particle exists, so that there, if this is if no particle satisfies this, then you could easily prove the opposite inequality. Okay. Just sum them all up, and you'll get the opposite inequality. So basically, this is saying, you know, if you did not have any particle that satisfied this criterion, you'll have an infinite every single extremal black hole will be stable, absolutely stable. It would not be able to decay, and you can have an extremal black hole for any value of the mass, and that means you would have an infinite number of exactly stable black holes. Okay. So as was just asked, what's wrong with that? That's a good question, and so I was always bothered by that question too. And so why don't we just since it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with it, what happens, maybe we could go, we could just, what happens if we just parametrically violate it? Let's violate as much as we can, and maybe we can find something that goes wrong if we violate as much as we can. And perhaps if something does go wrong, then maybe that thing that goes wrong will also tell us what's wrong with the original conjecture, the weaker conjecture, the stronger conjecture. So basically, since the WGC says the gravity is the weakest force, that's basically imposing a lower bound on the strength of the gauge force, right? So it's saying the gauge force cannot be weaker than something, okay? So let me just parameter, let me just maximally violate it by taking the strength of the gauge force all the way to zero, okay? So I'm gonna take the gauge force, so all charges, right? All charges are written by some integer multiple of the gauge coupling, and let me just take E to zero. So I'm basically taking the gauge force to zero, and therefore the gravitational force will be infinitely stronger than anything, okay? So let me see what happens if I do that. And I'm fixing M Planck, so I'm fixing the strength of gravity, okay? So in that limit, you'll be left over, of course, and the E goes to zero limit, you're left over with just a decoupled photon, right? Your photon will just decouple, and you'll be left with, you know, a matter sector that's charged under a global symmetry, okay? So you have a matter that's charged under a global symmetry and a decoupled photon, and again, that sounds like there's nothing wrong with that. But reminding you that I left M Planck non-zero, so gravity is on. I mean, there is dynamical gravity, and you might have heard, or it might be, it's a familiar statement that global symmetries actually do not play nicely with quantum gravity. The statement is that quantum gravity actually violates all global symmetries. I'm going to go through the standard argument for that. So, so the statement was, as you take E to zero, you get global symmetry, and since quantum gravity doesn't like global, since global symmetries are in a sense illegal in quantum gravity, there should be some limit, something that prevents you from taking the limit E goes to zero. So perhaps if we study the reason why this is true, we will figure out what the minimum value of E could be, okay, if we study this more carefully. And so here's just the basic argument for this. So let's say you form a black hole that has, you know, mass M and area A, and then you start feeding it. So I'm gonna try and assume that the black hole conserves, let's say, baryon number, you know, some global symmetry like baryon number. So I form a black hole, has a mass M and area A, and then it's gonna start Hawking evaporating, and as it's Hawking evaporating, I'm gonna feed it baryons at the same rate that it's Hawking evaporating. Okay, so I'm gonna feed it baryons at the same rate that it's Hawking evaporating. But as we know, Hawking radiation is actually ignorant of the baryon number. Hawking radiation is actually just a property of, you know, the vacuum, it's a property of a vacuum, of the vacuum right at the horizon of a black hole. Basically, the vacuum, Hawking pairs are this peeling apart of the vacuum of the right at the horizon of the black hole, and that horizon is causally disconnected from anything on the inside. So the Hawking radiation actually doesn't know anything about baryon number. So if the black hole was conserving baryon number, I mean, if the black hole, yeah, if these quantum gravitational processes conserve baryon number, the black hole will be acquiring a baryonic charge. Right, so as I feed it baryons, it'll have baryon number one, baryon number two, baryon number three, all with the same area. Okay, so, but the problem is that we end up losing the statistical interpretation of black hole entropy in the sense that, so there's evidence that, you know, the area of a black hole behaves like an entropy. And there's these laws of black hole mechanics, and these areas map, the area behaves just like an entropy, and the entropy follows a second law of thermodynamics and things. And if we want, we would like to interpret, in general, we'd like to interpret this entropy as the log of the number of microstates. Basically, yes? It's a similar argument you would give for why there's no, why remnants don't solve the information paradox.
Right, so, but we think the information problem should be solved somehow, so why can't we say the same words about that to the conservation of
something. So we think that remnants are not, so one of the previous solutions to the information paradox is a suggestion is that there's remnants. The black hole just stays as a remnant and the information never comes out. It's always in the black hole. But an argument against that is such a remnant would violate some entropy bound. And so the information, you know, must come out. So I'm trying to say the same thing, that if a black hole conserved baryon number, you would Oh yeah, so in this case,
baryons come out in the same way.
Yeah, so actually, so in this case, I'm trying to show that the argument will actually exist. So I'm assuming the black hole is big, it's still big, and it's in the regime where effective theory is valid. Of course, all these words are applied to things like firewalls and things, but I'm gonna, so my plan of the talk is I'm giving this as a standard argument, and then I'm gonna even further investigate why this is true. Okay, so I agree with you. There could be loopholes, you could complain about this, but right now this is the standard reason why this is true, and I guess you're right. If in some sense the baryon number can still non-locally jump out, is because I used the fact that the horizon was, you know, separated inside from the outside, and the, you know, some causal things have to travel non-locally. So this is a standard argument, but you're right. So there's still holes in this argument. So assuming that the black hole entropy counts the number of states, and that the horizon is, you know, is a causal horizon, things on the inside can't go on the outside. I'm going to show that then the black holes must, quantum gravity must violate baryon number, because if as you fed a baryon number, you know, let me come back again. These microstates are supposed to be, you know, they're quantum gravity, they're quantum mechanical states. You said, but each of these states, these are going to be the law. These are going to be the number of states that at large scales macroscopically look like the same black hole, right? So I'm going to count the number of states that look like that same black hole, even though they might be different quantum mechanical states. And if quantum gravity conserved baryon number, these states could be labeled by different baryon numbers. And by our thought process, we could show that we could have baryon number 0, 1, 2, all the way up to the E to S, and we could just keep on going. And so we would construct a set of states that whose macroscopic description was the same black hole, but the number of states was bigger than that given by the entropy. Okay, so you would lose this statistical interpretation of the entropy. But as was just complained, why do we believe this argument? One of the main reasons we actually believe this argument, at least the entropy counting argument is via, what should I say? So I guess I will say this is a very indirect argument. It's assuming a lot of other things. Ideally, we would just prove it. We would have some. If I say something like quantum gravity, doesn't violate global symmetries, your first question is, what do you mean by quantum gravity, right? So if I was able to give a non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity, then I could look and see if that definition of quantum gravity violated global symmetries, and everyone would be happy, right? Of course, but at the moment, I'm giving some, piecing together all these various other assumptions. So yes, I agree. We would like a direct proof. And also at the same time, such a direct proof, if I did have that quantum gravity, and I looked at to see what caused global symmetries to not be violated, I mean global symmetries to be violated, presumably it would also tell me what prevents the gauge coupling from going to zero. So if I take the gauge coupling to zero, I get a global symmetry, and that's as we said, that's going to be violated by quantum gravity. So presumably I can't take the gauge coupling to zero. And ideally, in the proof, if I was looking at some quantum theory of gravity and trying to prove this, the proof would probably give you some minimum value of the gauge coupling, right? I can't take the gauge coupling lower than a certain amount, otherwise I will violate something, right? And that something will have to be will be related to violating global symmetries. Okay. So we need a non-perturbative description of quantum gravity. Of course, it's very confusing. I mean, lots of people study that in this building. I mean, and we know at least such a description of quantum gravity would involve some path integral over space-time geometry, right? I'm just doing a path integral over various metrics weighted by this action, right? Of course, making sense of this action is very, very complicated and confusing, and it's not sure if it's non-perturbatively well-defined or anything like that. Along with that, I could restrict myself to a specific class of geometries, right? Conceptually, I could think of, let me put gravity in a box. I'm going to say it roughly. You put gravity in a box, I'm going to fix the metric, I'm going to fix the geometry on the boundary of the box, and then path integrate over all geometries that approach that specific geometry that I fixed on the boundary. Okay? An example of such an asymptotic boundary condition is called asymptotically ADS space. So ADS space behaves like a box, so you can conceptually think of doing quantum gravity in ADS space, basically. Again, it's the path integrals over all geometries on the inside, such that when you go to the boundary, they approach that of just ADS. Okay. And remarkably, at least, there's a lot of evidence, a lot of evidence that such a path integral is equal to a completely different path integral that we actually know how to non-perturbably define. It's equal to some path integral of a conformal field theory. Okay, a conformal field theory path integral we know how to define by a Wilsonian renormalization group and things. And so for this class of theories, the ADS, this is the ADS-CFT correspondence. The ADS-CFT correspondence is this path integral over geometries that asymptotically approach ADS. That path integral is equal to a CFT path integral. Okay? And it's basically, there are ADS-CFT pairs. For every CFT, there's going to be a corresponding, you know, quantum gravity. And in fact, another way of viewing this duality is that it's actually the same quantum field theory described in two different sets of variables, you know, same Hilbert space, everything, but you're just using two different sets of variables for the same theory. So in order to be useful, so again, we're investigating things. I'm assuming we're living in the ADS. So I'm trying to investigate the weak gravity conjecture, and more particularly in this case, whether or not gravity violates global symmetries in anti-de Sitter space. But we have a non-perturbative definition of anti-de Sitter space in terms of the conformal field theory. So now I'd like to translate this question into the conformal field theory. And maybe I could answer that question in the conformal field theory in a more satisfactory way. So in order to do the translation, you need a dictionary between these two theories. And in general, the dictionary is such that this is just some part of the dictionary, of course. You know, fields. So this side is, the ADS side, right, where the side we're interested in. And the different fields in the bulk in the ADS, the ADS side is also called the bulk. The different fields in the bulk, they correspond, so these ones are, you know, fields corresponding to specific particles in the ADS. This one is, you know, I'm going to just say what these things are. These are fields in the ADS. By gauge, I just mean gauge symmetries. A mu is going to be the photon field. This is the Planck scale, and E is the gauge coupling. And the correspondence is that fields in the bulk correspond to composite operators in the CFT. I'm sure you guys have seen this a lot. Gauge symmetries in the bulk in the ADS correspond to global symmetries. Therefore, the photon field corresponds to the current. So J mu is the conserved current associated with this global symmetry. This is just a specific example of this relation. The photon field in the bulk is A mu, and there's a corresponding field in the corresponding composite operator in the boundary in the CFT called J mu. And these two other things are the Planck scale in the ADS is going to be corresponding to the central charge in the CFT. And the 1 over the gauge coupling corresponds to the flavor central charge in the CFT. Okay? And these central charges, colloquially or intuitively, the central charge measures the number of degrees of freedom in the CFT, while the flavor central charge measures the number of degrees of freedom that are charged under this global symmetry. That's kind of the intuitive understanding of these two quantities. Moving on. Okay, so let's just translate the statement. So remember, we're saying we want to take E to 0 at fixed and Planck, right? So that translates to taking the flavor central charge to infinity at fixed regular central charge, okay? And remember, we said as at E goes to 0, you ended up with a decoupled photon, right? So at kappa goes to infinity, you're going to end up with a decoupled conserved current. Basically, all your conserved current, all your correlators in the CFT will factorize. The conserved current, if you have any correlator with conserved currents, you take a correlator of local operators in the CFT, and if you have conserved currents, they will just factorize separately, okay? Because I'm looking at the infinite central charge limit, infinite flavor central charge limit. So basically, I'm decoupling that. And so basically, in the end, so this is actually going to be, this kind of smells like a problem, because I'll have a set of correlators, and the flavors and the conserved current, so I'll have a set of correlators that are symmetric under some global symmetry, and the conserved current decoupled. Meaning, normally you want to write Ward identities and things where the conserved current is the thing that generates these global symmetries. But if in this case the conserved current is decoupled, so you actually have no conserved current in this limit, that you have no conserved current to generate the global symmetries. And so it seems like a violation of a Ciotti-Noether theorem, in the sense that normally you say any global symmetry, you have a conserved current. And therefore, in this case, this would be an example of having a global symmetry without a conserved current. Okay, but there's actually no proof of the Ciotti-Noether theorem in yet. There's no proof of that at the moment. So at the moment, so I'm just saying the fact that gravity does not conserve global symmetries translates into the statement the CFT satisfying a Noether theorem. Okay, so those are, yes?
I guess, again, it kind of goes back to your assumptions that you voice, that any CFT has a gravity dual.
Yes.
Which doesn't have to be the case. For example, in a real examples of ADS CFT correspondence, when there is an Einstein-Hilbert term that was a cosmological constant, there can be a Maxwell term. But the couplings of those are not necessarily completely independent. So usually, if I derive a model from string theory, so the couplings are fixed. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I am buying this, this statement that.
Are you disputing the statement that any?
Yeah, I am definitely disputing that statement. It's definitely not. I would say it's not true for sure that arbitrary CFT has. So there are quite a lot of conditions on the spectrum of
Optional
operators on all of that.
Okay, so yeah, you're right. I'm going under the assumption that the ADS CFT holds in the strongest form, basically that any CFT has dual to some quantum gravity in ADS. Let's chat about that later. So yeah, I'm going under that assumption to say these statements. Yes?
We often talk about setting quantum infinity.
Yes. Yes. Because when you say M Planck is infinity, then you say there's actually, you decouple gravity also in the bulk. So you are no longer, you're just now doing quantum field theory on, your bulk theory becomes a quantum field theory on curved space time.
That's right. And from the CFT point of view, we don't usually complain about violating another symmetry, conformal symmetry in the boundary or anything.
Yeah, you kind of do, yeah. To say that, yeah, the infinite central charge, you end up having some, these generalized CFTs.
Or would you say they're non-essential?
So I guess you decouple the stress sensor, right?
Yes.
So in a sense, yeah. So you would think that what would go into proving Noether's theorem has something to do with locality. So I'm talking about the existence of actually a conserved current, and that has to do with the existence of locality. And you would think that without the stress sensor, some definitions of locality is actually that there is a stress sensor, and so I guess. What are you saying? You're saying that So in those cases, there's no stress sensor in those infinite C limits. Yes.
And also, so you're trying to take a limit where the number of degrees of freedom charged under a global symmetry is larger than
exactly.
The number of degrees.
Exactly. That was my intuition as to why I think there should be a violation. This should be true. So if you think of a way of making that a proof, that would be great. Okay. yeah. Exactly. So this is—it's a very weird. It's a very. If you just take the intuitive definitions, the intuitive meanings of this, what was just stated is that C is a measure of the number of total degrees of freedom, and kappa is a. There we go. And kappa is a measure of the number of charged degrees of freedom. You would think there are going to be some. Yeah, that's actually this line here. The central charge should be tied to the Flavel central charge in the sense that if I start increasing the number of things charged under kappa, I will increase the things charged under C, and I can't take this limit. Yes.
Can you clarify what you mean by
a Flavel
central charge? I mean, in principle, I
could
have just a U1 without any
charge net. Yeah, the Flavel central charge is defined as the coefficient of the two-point function of the current. So if you have a conserved current and you take its two-point function, and under some normalization, you can define this.
So 1 over E is just a coupling of your Young-Mills sector, right?
In the
1 over E squared, right? I'm misunderstanding something. So what I'm saying is that just because you couple electromagnetism, there is a coupling there, doesn't necessarily mean that I have lots of. So in principle, like
exactly. Yeah. So yeah, in the bulk. Yeah. So it is. It is kind of interesting, right? So the having a weak electromagnetic coupling in the bulk, in the ADS, corresponds to having a lot of things charged under a global symmetry in the CFD. So this is similar to having a weak gravitational coupling corresponds to having a large central charge. This is why you normally need large N theories to have a weakly coupled gravity dual. So there's definitely a relationship in general between weak couplings in the bulk and large numbers of degrees of freedom in the CFD. Okay. I'm just going to give one slide on this. I personally was trying to investigate this using the conformal bootstrap. The conformal bootstrap basically is the conformal bootstrap equations are a set of consistency conditions that all CFTs must satisfy. So my goal was perhaps I could try and show that for a large enough flavor central charge, again for a fixed central charge, such a CFT cannot satisfy the conformal bootstrap equations. So I just wanted to show that perhaps if you violated this Noether theorem, the CFT Noether theorem, you actually at the same time cannot be a solution. You cannot solve the conformal bootstrap equations. Okay, that's it. This is ongoing work. Actually, when Chris asked me to come here 2 weeks ago, I thought I had a result. I did a numerical calculation and I thought I had a result, and I was like, yes, I'm going to go talk about this result. But then a little less than a week ago, I visited Jared Kaplan, and he killed that result. But the phrasing of this is still okay. I mean, I'm still saying that. This is one way of going about proving. I mean, I think to me this is the most rigorous way I can think of understanding the WGC. Of course, there might be complaints about that. So let me move on.
You have to look at correlators of J and T.
Yeah, so I can go. We could talk after about what I actually did. Let me move on. So the next thing is that the WGC requires model. Oh, here it is, this one. The WGC requires model builders to include particles and cutoffs to ensure all black holes can decay. So now I'm moving on, putting on a different hat. So let's just accept the WGC, right? And we want to build a model that's consistent with it. Basically, as model builders in general, you're assuming that your model can be completed by string theory. So therefore, if the WGC is true, you would want your model to be, to satisfy it. You don't want to guarantee that you're in the swampland. Okay, so here's just a set of simple rules that Raman and me and Prashant came up with. I think this is a most universally agreed upon set of rules by various people who've been working on the WGC. So regardless, irrespective of whether you believe the WGC, if you now want to just be conservative and satisfy the WGC in your model, and saying these are the things you should do. Okay, and the first one is do not impose exact global symmetries. I'm going to go over these a little bit more in more detail, one by one. But the first statement is, do not impose any exact global symmetries. Of course, as I was just saying, the issue of exact global symmetries is continuously connected to the issue of WGC to begin with. So I'm going to start off by saying, do not impose exact global symmetries. The next thing is, make sure all electric and magnetic black holes can decay. So for any U1, I'm going to and then finally, I'm going to go through these slowly anyway. And finally, take into account the cutoffs due to magnetic monopoles. Basically, if I have a magnetic black hole and I need to make it to decay, I'm going to introduce a magnetic monopole for that black hole to decay. And such a magnetic monopole, in general, points to a cutoff. It points to a cutoff in the theory where your U1 breaks down, where your theory of the U1 gauge field breaks down. And so we have to take those into account. Okay. So the first rule is do not impose exact global symmetries. So remember, as we just talked for a long time, that quantum gravity we're assuming it violates all global symmetries. So therefore, any effective theory below any effective theory of quantum gravity should have a higher infinite tower of higher dimensional operators, all that violate global symmetries. So I'm just saying, don't tune an infinite number of these higher dimensional operators to zero. And basically, another way of phrasing it is just to say that all global symmetries are accidental. I think model builders in general do this. They assume that global symmetries are just accidental. They don't really need to tune an infinite number of them because only a few relevant ones are in general relevant. I have to stipulate this. The next is to make sure that all electric and magnetic black holes decay. So I'm going to generalize. You generalize the WGC to multiple U1s. For each U1, assume that there exists both magnetically and electrically charged black holes. The Einstein-Maxwell solutions do have magnetically charged black holes. So we're going to assume that those magnetically charged black holes exist. And now we just want to require that all such black holes can decay. Okay? And so now we're going to just come up with a condition with when you have multiple U1s. This is just going to be pretty fast. I'm not going to go through all the algebra because it's very simple. Since I have a black hole that's charged under multiple U1s, it's going to be given, I can label charge by charge vector, right, Q. And let's say that charged black hole decays into many different fields, into many different particles, like ni particles of charge 2i and mass mi. Okay? And again, I'm going to require that this is true, that this is possible, that this decay is kinematically possible. So basically, I need to follow charge conservation requires this, the sum of all the charges equals this charge and the total charge. And similarly, the sum of all the masses should be less than the initial mass. Okay. And actually, if this can be geometrized, right? There's a nice geometric picture that encapsulates this. Basically, the picture is the convex hull in charge to mass ratio space must contain the unit ball. All you do is you look at your set of particles. For each particle, you find the charge to mass ratio for that particle. You draw that charge to mass ratio here, right? So I'm going to draw a QI MI. So this is some charge to mass ratio space, and the convex hull of all those vectors should contain the unit circle. And the convex hull is some technical term, but you can visualize it as if you draw these vectors, and then you put like a rubber band around it, and you stretch the rubber band tightly, this area enclosed on the inside is the convex hull. Okay, and so this is an example where with this set of charges, the extremal black holes can decay. All extremal black holes can decay, and with this set of charges, some extremal black holes cannot decay because it's not completely encompassing the unit ball. And now we need to take into account cutoffs because we had to do that for the electric charges as well as the magnetic charges. And the viewpoint on the magnetic charges is that, in general, we're thinking our U1, any theory in which you complete the U1 to a bigger theory, let's say a grand unified theory or extra dimensions or lattice gauge theory, the low energy theory will have monopoles. Okay, and that low energy theory, well, probably not any all of them, but in these, if you have monopoles, that low energy theory will have monopoles, and those monopoles will be given by, will have a size, and that size will be given by the cutoff of the theory. Basically, when lambda is the energy scale at which this U1 theory gives way to this UV theory, okay? And similarly, the mass of the monopole is also a measure of where this cutoff is. It's given by lambda over E squared, and you can think of this mass as just being equal to parametrically, it's equal to the magnetic field energy stored outside a ball of radius 1 over lambda. Okay. So, so for model building, we introduced these magnetic monopoles so that magnetically charged black holes can decay. But by introducing them, now that we have those monopoles, we're going to assume they're just like any other standard monopoles we've seen. And that signifies that our U1 theory is going to break down at some energy scale lambda given by this. So now you just have to take these lambdas into account with our model building. Okay. So to satisfy these rules, just don't depose any exact global symmetries. Make sure all electric and magnetic black holes can decay, and then take into account any magnetic monopoles, the cutoffs due to magnetic monopoles that you introduced. So I'm going to move on to my third message. And the third message is, despite recent claims, two axion models can achieve trans-Planckian field transits while remaining consistent with the WGC. So again, there's been recent claims that there are a certain class of models that you cannot achieve trans-Planckian field transits with, and because they would violate the WGC. But what we'll do is we're just going to construct one of those models following these rules and show that it does achieve trans-Planckian field displacements. But there will be no need to go through all the algebra because there's going to be some simple loophole in this recent claims so that you guys will, everyone would believe that such a model then should be possible if you notice that loophole. So I'm first going to talk about these recent claims. So first I got a little bit of background on trans-Planckian. I haven't even talked about trans-Planckian field transits and axions yet. So by general, by trans-Planckian field transits, I'm just talking about, so this is supposed to be the potential of a scalar field. This potential goes upwards, the scalar field goes this way. By trans-Planckian field transits, I'm just saying, I'm assuming that a scalar field has a VEV, and I'm saying in time that VEV is going to move a certain distance, and by trans-Planckian it means it moves a distance bigger than the Planck length, like this. So as time goes by, the value of the scalar field is going to move this way many Planck distances. Okay, this is just, I'm defining what trans-Planckian means. And such models are very useful in things like inflation. Right? Any inflation model that predicts gravity waves, observable gravity waves, essentially most of them will have trans-Planckian field transits, involve trans-Planckian field transits. Also, the person I'm substituting for, David Kaplan, he had a model of solving the hierarchy problem, which also involved trans-Planckian field transits. So there's many reasons why you might want trans-Planckian field transits. So, of course, one of the very first things that's stated about trans-Planckian field transits is the so-called trans-Planckian problem. Basically, again, we're taking if you take the effective theory viewpoint that you should have all these higher dimensional operators suppressed by the Planck scale, then if your phi moves multiple times m Planck, then there'll be some values of phi where this is bigger, where phi over m Planck is bigger than one, and this is a bad expansion. Okay. Of course, what you have in mind, what you really would want, but you can't really require it, is it'd be nice if you could say something like I have a shift symmetry, where if phi was equal, if phi was shift symmetric, meaning phi was equal, if phi and phi plus c were both was a symmetry of the potential, then I can, you know, or if I can impose this symmetry, then I could get rid of all these terms, because these terms are invariant under these terms change under that substitution. But of course, that would break one of our rules for constructing these models. So I'm going to say what might seem like a good starting point, just motivating as a good starting point, is an angular variable, because perhaps if you have an angular variable, so by angular variable I mean you have a complex field parameterized by a radius and an angle, and you think maybe that's a good starting point because now you're just moving around and around in field space as opposed to a long distance in radius, and so maybe that's a good starting point. So. Yes, it's going to be discrete. Yes. At the moment, I'm just writing it this way. I haven't said it's actually symmetric under the discrete. Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorry, I heard what you said. So, in fact, it's a discrete symmetry in the sense that it's really just I'm viewing the field space as compact itself. The field space is compact. That's what I mean by the discrete symmetry. Okay, so. And such fields, just the terminology, these fields that are angular variables are called axions. Just call them. That's a generic name for these fields. And given that it's periodic and has the shift symmetry, this discrete shift symmetry, that the corrections to the potential or the contributions to the potential should also be periodic. And in general, they're generally organized in a form like this, which is called an instanton expansion. Right, I'm going to look at the contribution from one class of instantons, is you call this the one instanton contribution, the two instanton contribution, and so on. And and this is basically a Fourier expansion, but these coefficients have this specific relation to each other. This is something that commonly comes out of these. This is a common form for the potential. And now if we wanted this potential to give allow for trans-Planckian field transits. Remember, I want the field to be able to roll a long distance. Let me just start by ignoring this term and looking at this term. Of course, if I want to roll a long distance, I'm going to need the cosine to have a trans-Planckian period, right? So it doesn't go back up. So the requirement will be f is going to be bigger than m Planck. That's clearly true. And also, since I just said it, I started off by saying let me ignore these terms. Let me require that this s is called the instanton action. And this f is called the axion decay constant. So I'm going to require that this s to be greater than 1, so that these higher order terms are suppressed. Okay. So the claim is that this is a sufficient condition to have a trans-Planckian field transits. Okay. You have your axion decay constant greater than Planck and s greater than 1. Okay, so that was the background for just why you wanted axions and how axions are related to trans-Planckian field transits. So historically, people have been trying to realize such an effective potential in string theory for a long time. You start off, an attendee string theory, you compactify, and you try and land on that effective potential with where you have a F greater than M Planck. And they've been having a hard time. Okay, and so these recent papers have been suggesting that the reason they're having a hard time is because it's just impossible. The WGC, if it's true, would just say that all such attempts are just impossible because all such attempts are any such potential is actually in the swamp land. So that's the claim of these recent papers, that these string theory constructions would just never possibly succeed. It gives a reason as to why it was so hard, why they were having such a hard time, just because it's impossible. So where do the axions? So let's look more at their claim. Let's analyze where the axions come from. In general, axions in string theory come from these p-form gauge fields. These are just fancier versions. They're just fancy names for saying completely anti-symmetric tensors with p indices. And this is a one-form gauge field, the one we're used to, a two-form, three-form. And in general, by a gauge field, it means it's invariant under a gauge transformation. This is the familiar one, A goes to A mu plus D mu lambda. Two forms have a little bit more complicated of a gauge transformation. Okay. Three forms too. And in general, these axions are the extra dimensional components of gauge fields. So again, we start in a higher dimensional string theory and you compactify down to four dimensions, you're gonna have all these extra compact dimensions. And if you point the extra components of these gauge fields along those directions, you get axions. More specifically, for example, let's say the fifth dimension is a circle, and let me do this integral. I'm gonna wrap the A5 around the fifth dimension, do this integral. This is really more of a generalized Arnabon effect from going around the fifth dimension, right? And so this is the claim, this is axion. And in if you want, you can do the same thing with this two form. You can, instead of having, the fifth and sixth dimensions can be, a torus or a sphere, a two sphere, and you can do the same thing. And again, the reason they're axions, is that the field space is periodic, as was just asked. They're invariant under a shift symmetry in the sense that under a class of gauge transformations, if you do a gauge transformation, under some gauge transformations, you're able to shift the axion by some integer multiple of 2 pi. So under some gauge transformations, the axion shifts under integer multiples of 2 pi. Therefore, you need to identify all of those because you're modding out by the gauge transformation. So this is just saying why it even deserves the name axion is because it actually is a periodic variable. There's a discrete, you're gauging by this discrete symmetry, of shifting by 2 pi, okay? And so what do the string theorists do, the string phenomenologists do? So we've been talking about axions, and we've been talking about how axions are related to these p-form gauge fields, but now we want to bring in where the weak gravity conjecture comes in. And in general, the general strategy they do is that they just use various duality, let me just read it. They use various dualities to relate axions to U1s, and then you apply to WGC. For example, here's some 10 or 11 D supergravity, and you assume that you go to low energies and you get the axion. But let's say this axion was, from the fifth component of that U1 gauge field. So at this point, you'll apply the WGC. Alternatively, you could go compactify in a different direction and use a different field, let's say the two-form gauge field. But under various string dualities, t-dualities and things, p-forms get mapped into other p-prime forms. And by various dualities, you can now map this to another U1 that came from somewhere else. And then you could apply the weak gravity conjecture here and then move down. So basically, you start with your axion and you move all along various dualities and things to find out until you get to a U1, and then you apply the weak gravity conjecture to that U1. And then, surprisingly, you get kind of consistent results doing that. And basically, the results end up being that you could just rephrase the results in terms of the axion actions and decay constants. So the original result is, so once the idea is once you get to the U1, once you get to go to some frame where you have the U1, you say M is, you require that there's a particle M is less than EM Planck. And then once you go back to the axion language, that says there's going to be, you're requiring that there's an instanton whose action is less than M Planck over F. Okay, that's how it ends up translating. So basically, morally, the mass of an axion becomes is translated to the instanton action, and the charge of axion is the charge. So the mass of the charge particle is translated to the instanton action, and the charge is translated to 1 over the axion of the decay constant, and you get a relation like this. But as we were saying earlier, we're requiring that F be bigger than M Planck, right? We wanted trans Planckian, we wanted a large decay constant, right? So by definition, we were requiring that the period of the cosine had a period multiple times the Planck scale, but that is requiring that there's going to be an instanton action that's less than 1. Okay, so let me go to this. I will have to end. Remember, we simultaneously wanted F bigger than M Planck and S greater than 1. F bigger than M Planck, so even this guy had a allowed for trans Planckian displacement, and S greater than 1, so you suppress these higher order terms. Okay, so the claim would be that because of these unwanted instantons that you need to introduce to satisfy the weak gravity conjecture, your higher order terms are always going to be important. You go, okay, that's the claim. And let's see. So you might, you might think, oh, let me try it in multi-axion space, because that was just saying that one axion with one decay constant get it so big. But remember, an axion is the axion field range is a circle. What if I do two axions? So I have two circles. Two circles is a torus, and let me generate the potential in some funny direction so that now, even though both of these distances are less than M Planck, I can go down a weird direction many, many times before I get back and get multiple, trans Planckian field displacements. But again, you have to apply this. You have to do the same thing. Since you have multiple axions, you have to apply this to multiple U1 gauge fields, and you apply the convex hull, and again, the same thing doesn't work. So there's a theorem that you cannot have an effective F, you cannot have an effective F greater than M Planck and have all your instanton actions greater than 1, okay? And therefore, you think you might conclude that the trans Planckian field transits via multiple axions is impossible. But actually, I think there's a jump from going from here to here. So we agree with this. This is a true statement. We agree with this statement. However, going from here to here is a jump. Remember, there were conceptually two different things. S greater than 1 meant you wanted control over the higher harmonics, while this F greater than M Planck is what we were saying. So S greater than 1 was saying we wanted control over higher harmonics. And so basically, saying S greater than 1, it was a sufficient condition to have these trans Planckian field transits. But we're saying it's actually not a necessary condition. And so I'm going to really fast just say what our model is. Our model, so we have a model that actually gives you trans Planckian field displacements. It's just basically you have two gauge fields and two massless particles. One massless particle of charge 1 and n, another massless particle of charge 0 and 1. And essentially, these massless particles will generate, as we were saying, potentials for these gauge fields. And it generates such a potential that in the end of the day, you do end up getting this effective single action potential with trans Planckian field display with F that's bigger than M Planck. Okay? And so you might wonder, so what was the loophole? And it evades the theorem because in this case, we actually have S equals 0. We had to include all those our higher order terms were not exponentially suppressed. But if you actually do the calculation, in this case, you could actually explicitly calculate the higher order terms, and you get something that looks like this. You get terms that are suppressed by 1 over n to the fifth. And if you actually just look at this and analyze it, these higher order terms do not destroy this trans Planckian field transit. So in general, the statement would be this. I would say the no-go theorem is not really a theorem. It's just a guarantee that it's going to be difficult because from the top down, you're saying that there's going to be all these particles that are appearing that can have a strong effect on your potential, and you have to worry about them. But from the bottom up, so the difference is really from a point of view. From the bottom up, we can just specify the spectrum and then calculate, right? Let me just specify what it is and then calculate. And I don't have to make some order of magnitude guesses about what those higher order terms are. We can just calculate it. And in this case, so that's what we do. And from the top down, people from the top down might just say, aren't you just moving the target elsewhere? Now aren't you trying to say, don't you have to now explain where your spectrum comes from? And of course, effective field theorists from bottom up will just say, exactly. That's what you generally are trying to do. You just specify we're moving the problem elsewhere, to higher energies, to somewhere else where there's no go theorem. So let me conclude by saying, am I explaining my title, the WG for everyone? So it's for formal field theorists and string theorists because you're rephrasing the conformal theory, rephrasing the WCC in terms of CFT and other theorems. It's also for model builders because it gives you extra constraints on particles and cutoffs, and by requiring extra particles and cutoffs. And it's also for string phenomenologists because it helps them, it explains to them why some potentials are hard to realize. And of course, there's been some confusion in the literature, but that confusion is kind of due to some unwanted mixing between these two species of everyone. But so anyway, that's it.
All right, so I'm getting on.